Up next, we're going to talk about mythical creatures. We're going to talk about the practice of Reiki. Alfonso Colasuono joins us. And get ready next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you about our guest. Alfonso Colasuono has had 65 works of short fiction and poetry published in 35 literary magazines. That's quite an accomplishment. He was the co-author and editor-in-chief of Beautiful Losers magazine, a literary magazine dedicated to poetry, short fiction, and nonfiction. He instructs aspiring and emerging writers on how to advance their careers through his influential blog, The Literary Game, and his book is called The Book of the Magical Mythical Unicorn. Alfonso, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, George. It's an honor and a privilege to speak with you today.
How did you get interested in mythical legends and creatures?
You know, it's a weird and winding story. It all started really when I was 24 as a New York City teaching fellow. And let's just say that did not go very well. And basically, I was fired from my job as a special education teacher in New York City. And
you must have been crushed when that happened.
It was very crushing. I basically wanted to be a teacher my entire life, and then my first assignment at a school, I really loved the kids I was working with, but it just didn't go well. Me and the administration didn't really see eye to eye about different strategies. So, you know, when you have one sort of life plan and then that's kind of taken away from you, you got to really know how to regroup. And at the time, I didn't know how to regroup, so I just basically moved back in with my mother.
Sure.
And kind of had a lost year back there in 2009. And one of the things that we would always do during that lost year is just watch old episodes of The X-Files. And one of the episodes in that show featured Fox Mulder, one of the stars of the show, main character, undergoing past life regression.
Aha.
Hypnosis.
Okay.
And I had never heard of past life regression hypnosis, and you know, I was pretty murky at the time about reincarnation because I'd always had an interest in the paranormal and the supernatural and things of the sort, but I didn't, you know, honestly at the time I didn't really believe most of it. It was kind of just more entertainment to me. But you know, my life was in a lot of turmoil at the time, and I figured, you know, hey, let's get online and
look. Yeah, what could you lose, right?
There's absolutely nothing to lose, so I just went on to a search engine and just typed in New York City, past life regression hypnosis, and I found out that there was a hypnotist actually at the Edgar Cayce Center in New York City.
Okay, great. And a great center, too.
Yes, absolutely. And this hypnotist, Ellie Bill Lewis, I called him, I booked an appointment, and I didn't really have any expectations on what to really expect from you know, from that sort of session. But from that, I was amazed at the kind of lives that I regressed. And I was kind of just expecting to go in there, and the hypnotist try to do his job, and, you know.
Nothing would happen,
right? A few hundred
dollars
poorer from, you know, not working. So
when you got some of the past life regression information from him, did he tape you? Or did he just tell you?
Well, he was taping me as I was regressing this. It was actually kind of, I'm not sure if this is really common for hypnotists of the sort, but what he would do to start to get me into that hypnotic state is he just sort of used a bunch of words in nonsensical ways, and I think it's probably to get the brain tripped up. I'm a very logical person with the way I process things, and I think he was trying to trip that mechanism. And it worked, and I started regressing these different past lives from various cultures and time periods, and I was amazed to see who I was before I, you know, incarnated in this body and this current life that I was leading. I didn't really expect that anything would actually happen. I just was treating it like a fun game to see if there was anything that would happen, and lo and behold, I was really surprised.
What were some of the past lives, Alfonso?
Well, the first life that I regressed was actually around 1000, the year 1000, and I was an Egyptian Muslim in that life, and I basically wandered around the Sahara Desert into, you know, just kind of as a wanderer, and the real singular moment in that life was when I was in present-day Tunisia, And when I was there, as a Muslim, I was speaking to a rabbi, and he informed me that, you know, there is no separation. There's no Muslim and Jew. There's no me and you. Everything is one. And it kind of blew my mind. That was a singular moment that I really remembered in that life. And not every life that I had was as positive as that. I had one life where I was a woman in southeastern Germany around the year 1500, and I was actually practicing dark magic in the forest. I came from a very educated family, and I basically just left my life behind when I was 14 years old and went off into the forest, and just a really dark life. I did a lot of things that I wasn't proud of, or I'm not proud of now.
I understand.
And a couple other lives. One was in colonial America around southern Illinois or western Kentucky, somewhere around there. And was basically kind of the charismatic guy that everyone loves but no one really respects. And even though it was really surprising just for the time period, around 1800 or so, I actually converted to Islam. And towards the end of my life, I actually sailed across the Atlantic into Morocco, and that was where I died shortly thereafter. And the last life that I really remember was actually very shortly after, where I was in France near the border of Italy, and that was a really bad life. My wife was attacked by an invading army.
Oh, jeez.
I think I was in the French Navy at the time, and I might have drowned off my ship. So, it was a real mix of good, bad, and ugly in these four different lives, but none of them were anything that I expected.
What did the session do for you afterwards?
You know, it basically made me realize that there's something to it. Not to everything in the paranormal and the supernatural, but to a good amount. And it really opened my mind to all those things. I started experimenting with different things like biohacking using binaural beats and isochronic tones. So, you know, if I had a cold or something of the sort, I would use it, and I started seeing some good results. So I just started opening my mind up more and more to these kinds of things and realizing that there's a lot to it, to many of these, practices.
How did you get involved in energy healing from that?
You know, again, it's kind of a little bit of an interesting story, but I was dating this woman, this artist, Isabel Wall, at the time, and she had been going to this energy healer in New York City, a woman by the name of Stephanie Erdang, and, I was dealing with a bunch of different health issues, and it was a little bit more severe than the isochronic tones or binaural beats could really handle.
Right, okay.
So I just told my girlfriend, and she said, I go for tune-ups to this woman. You should give it a try. And having already had those hypnosis sessions and seeing those past life regressions, you know, that the former skepticism that I might have had, I just decided to give it a shot. And from that practice, it was really amazing. I had never had any sort of really odd thing that can't be explained by, present-day understanding of science or the five senses. When she was doing the treatment without even touching me physically, when she was treating me for these illnesses, I started feeling it's the weirdest thing. I can only describe it as an energetic snake that was slithering up and down my side.
You could feel that too, right?
You could definitely feel it. And I told her about it, and she was, pretty elusive in terms of explaining the meaning. To this day, she never really explained it, and I'm not quite sure why, but I just know that having that physical sensation, it really led me to start thinking there's something to this energy healing. And, there's always different things that come up with health and other things where you could need a little extra help. And it's just not feasible to go to someone, on a weekly basis, a monthly basis. Life takes you in different cities, different states, and all that. So I just decided, is there a way that I can learn this on my own? And I went on a search engine again, and I saw that there was a woman named Pamela Miles in New York City who was inducting people into Reiki. And I signed up for a class, and I decided to start doing some of this Reiki energy healing. And, and that's kind of how it started.
And you're a Reiki practitioner now, right?
Yes, and it's done great things for me just in terms of keeping balanced, keeping healthy, no problems here with this COVID crisis and all that stuff. Yeah, I have pretty great health and just stay balanced. And
good.
I think a lot of these great things are really due to the Reiki practice, my daily Reiki practice.
You were 24 when things collapsed. At what age were you when you were starting to put things together again?
You know, I must have been about 28, 29 when things started really, really falling into place.
Good. So you went through 3 or 4 years of a really rough time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the worst year was that first year right after getting fired as a teacher. But every year got progressively better. But by the time I got that, induction into first degree Reiki with Pamela, that's when things really started getting into place and just amazing things started happening. And it basically opened up a whole new life.
Did you ever go back to teaching, or you're a Reiki practitioner full time now?
You know, I've gone back to teaching. I had a wonderful experience for a few years at a college in the Bronx. Great students, a really supportive administration, fun coworkers. They really gave me the kind of freedom to run with. My style is pretty unorthodox as a teacher, just like it's pretty unorthodox in just about everything I do. But they saw that it was good. But even so, after 3 years working at that college, I knew it kind of wasn't my path. So I decided to trade the good for the better and really just start exploring different opportunities after that.
Now, how did you go from what you're doing now, a Reiki practitioner, to writing a book on magical, mythical unicorns?
You know, I mean, George, if we were talking back then after, shortly after getting inducted to Reiki and starting to practice it, I still would have been really skeptical about the unicorn at the time and other mythological creatures. I've always been kind of a doubting Thomas by nature, so sometimes you got to beat me over the head, too.
But that's healthy. There's nothing wrong with being a doubter, I don't think, as long as you're open to the possibility that you could be wrong.
Yeah, I've just been lucky that the things I have explored have definitely had results, but I definitely know there's some things that are, not quite credible, but in my experience with Reiki and others. But what really got me to this point where I'd write a book about the unicorn was actually my first real supernatural experience. And I was working with a startup for a while called Old Forgotten Art Found, which sought to recover art that was stolen by the Nazis during and after World War II. And, once provenance is verified, return it to the rightful owners. And so we were trying to amass a good team of all different people, film people, because it was supposed to be a televised, global hunt for this art. And I was going to, as a leader on the project, one of the leaders on the project, going to interview some new team members, potential team members. And around that time, I started hearing for the first time about chemtrails. And once I started hearing about that, basically, every time I went outside, my eyes were always glued to the skies, and you'd see those, trails, pretty regularly over New York City, which is where I was living at the time. But, one day, it was a beautiful day, sunny, not a chemtrail in the sky, but I did see something far odder than any chemtrail. I saw what could only be described as a UFO isn't really the term because it wasn't flying. But it was a stationary object that looked like a cube, and it was almost like a light switch. If you have a dimmer on your light switch in your home, it was fading into the sky, and then reemerging, almost like turning it off and on, and it stayed completely stationary. So as I was walking from my home in New York to the subway, to go over to these interviews to interview these potential team members. I just stayed glued to the sky, and it was the weirdest thing seeing this cube. It didn't move at all, and seeing something like that for the first time, first getting that energy healing and then becoming a Reiki practitioner, and then seeing something like that, I realized, okay, actually there's a lot more of these things that are credible, once you see something with your own eyes.
Oh, yeah, makes you a believer.
Yep. Absolutely. And so, when I, after seeing that, I started being a lot more open to what people were talking about. And, and, you know, just the different possibilities of that nature.
Well, now, how did the unicorns pop up?
You know, it actually comes back to the same energy healer that I that kind of helped kickstart this journey.
And a unicorn, for people who don't know, is like a horse with a single horn in its head, right?
Yes, yes, that's a good way to describe it. And so I was a writer by trade and doing a lot of things that are a little bit outside the supernatural, just kind of mostly literary fiction and kind of things kind of reminiscent maybe of Charles Bukowski, you know, in poetry and fiction. But I had been working on Old Forgotten Art Found, but we couldn't get the funding. And I'd also been working with another entrepreneur and a hedge fund manager, a guy by the name of Jeff Spitalnik. And I'd been working with him for 9 months, and he passed away from Ewing sarcoma, a rare form of bone cancer.
Oh.
So we were set to release an iOS app, which was going to kind of revolutionize the keyboards you have on your phones. And I was also doing Old Forgotten Art Found. So I had given everything to these projects. And then in the span of 2 months, it was sort of like, you know, after all this forward traction in my life, everything kind of fell apart once again.
Again.
And
yeah.
I was really at a loss. So even being a Reiki practitioner, I just came to Stephanie again, just get a little extra reinforcement. And I told her, you know, a little bit about my situation. And she had been seeing this woman, Vikasha Brendan, who was looking for a writer for a book about the unicorn that she had started back in the 1990s. But had never found the right writer to partner with. And I was a writer now, just without a project. And basically, Stephanie Erdang, one of the energy healers who got me on this journey in the first place, played matchmaker with me and Vikasha and set us up. And when Vikasha told me that she wanted to write a book about the unicorn, you know, I didn't know much about the unicorn at all, and it seemed like a really fascinating opportunity to really just explore a totally new concept and find out, you know, is there some truth to this, just like there was with Reiki and other energy healing, just like there was with the object I saw in the sky? And I really want to just keep an open mind about it. So, you know, when Vikasha offered me to work with her on this, I said absolutely.
Did unicorns possess any special powers, Alfonso?
Yeah, one of the greatest powers that they have, that there's lots of legends. It's really their ability to use their horn to remove poison. There's a legend called the water conning story that spans different cultures from India to the Middle East to Europe, where a unicorn would dip its horn into poisoned waters, and it would purify it. And many of these, you know, many of these poisoned waters all of these poisoned waters became pure to drink, and animals would start drinking from these streams and rivers and lakes again. And, yeah, so that's probably the foremost thing that they're really associated with in terms of that respect.
Could they fly? Did they have that capability?
You know, they could. They're pretty amazing in terms of what they can do. Not only can they fly, but they're, you know, I believe from the research that we did, that they're interdimensional creatures, you know, sort of like fairies, in that they can come in and out of our dimension, but a little bit differently because they come in, you know, only when they're needed. That's why you don't see them every day like you would a horse or a dog or a cat or any other animals of the sort.
You know, it's interesting because they go way, way back in terms of their mythology. I wonder who created them. Let's talk more about them when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll take your calls next hour about Reiki or the unicorns with Alfonso Colasuono, who has written the book called The Book of the Magical Mythical Unicorn. Alfonso, is it possible, is it conceivable that the unicorn was a real animal and just got extinct or something like that?
I think absolutely. And I think one of the biggest forms of evidence to kind of prove that point that we made in the Book of the Magical Mythical Unicorn is the fact that if you look at some of the most ancient cultures going back about 6,000, 5,000, 4,000 years ago, like the Sumerians, like the ancient Chinese, like in Egypt, going into the Indus Valley civilizations of South Asia, all of these, some of the first civilizations to really emerge in our era, they all sort of had depictions of the unicorn. in their art, in some of the earliest literature that survives. And you have to really think about the fact that if you go back really before 200, 300 years ago, how little really survives of the historical record, much less 6,000 years ago. And the fact that these cultures, all of them, have depictions of the unicorn. See, I'm pretty skeptical by nature, so I could understand if it was just, say, the Sumerians. Maybe they took an oryx, you know, from a side profile or some other animal. But to see it across different cultures.
Oh, the Greeks would, you know, they were into this. I mean, it was Chinese. It was all over the place.
Absolutely, George. All of these different cultures throughout Europe, Asia, and Africa, and, you know, to a little bit of a lesser extent here in the Americas, they all had depictions of the unicorn in various ways throughout their mythology. We saw this in different spiritual traditions, too, you know, in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, even Zoroastrianism, all these different depictions. And so that really, really, you know, convinced me that not only am I writing kind of a fun book here with Vikasha, but there's actually something to it. And there was, there were many sort of encounters. Not frequent, but enough to be in the historical record with many notable figures throughout these cultures and different time periods.
And it seems like a creature that was pretty docile. There was doesn't seem like there was any danger to it or anything like that.
No, nothing at all. And, you know, maybe depending on your point of view, almost too docile. One of the biggest legends that really emerged, you know, sort of out of Europe really popularized it, but it was also prevalent in the Middle East and in India, is the holy hunt, where, you know, you're kind of looking at young upstarts who want to impress religious figures or royal figures and really kind of make a career. So when they knew that a unicorn may or would appear in a certain place or that there was a high likelihood for there, they would organize bands of hunters to try to track it down and kill it. And even though the unicorn is an interdimensional creature, it can pop in and out, it has power far greater than any person, it is bound not to use any lethal force or even anything that could really physically harm any person. There's a tradition in China where not only wouldn't it harm a person, but it's said to not even trample a blade of grass just because of the damage of that sort.
Jeez.
So yeah, with a creature as peaceful as the unicorn, you got some people who, you know, didn't really care about that, the ethics of it, and they would organize bands of hunters, and sometimes they were successful, and that's how a lot of horns started getting into circulation or fragments of horns throughout time. It was from these bands of hunters that sometimes would be able to successfully slay a unicorn.
You know, we've got the stories of the Loch Ness Monster. We have Bigfoot, Sasquatch stories. I guess you could put the unicorn into that bunch too, couldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of similar to you know, cryptids of the sort, like the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot. But they're also different in the sense that unicorns have a special purpose. Really, they come in infrequently. But a lot of the times when you think about historical figures that they appeared to, it's usually to herald some breakthrough in humanity. One of the earliest Chinese emperors, Fu Xi, was actually said to have encountered a unicorn as a way to help his people through the gift of language. Fu Xi's people, according to the sources that we found, were unable to have a written language to better communicate and all the problems that sort of came from that. And so Fu Xi was meditating for kind of an answer to this problem, and the unicorn, which in China is called the Qi Lin, appeared to him, and on his back, miraculously enough, many of the characters of the Chinese language started appearing, and he used that as a way to really revolutionize things. And you know, with China having such a rich history throughout, you know, millennia, I think a lot of that, according to these legends, you know, it really starts with the unicorn kind of propelling that whole sort of civilization forward.
And tell me this, have you ever had any experience, fictional or otherwise, with a unicorn yourself?
You know, if I hadn't had those experiences with energy healing and with the, you know, the object in the sky, you know, I should have realized that I might have had one with the unicorn too. But again, that doubting nature in me still came in. And when I started work with Vikasha, because she had some mobility and health issues, I had to work in her house while we were writing this book. And she told me, which I thought was just kind of a joke, that some people who stay with her are known to have experiences with the unicorn. And, you know, the first 7 or 10 days we were working on this, nothing out of the ordinary happened. You know, we were getting to know each other. But as I went to bed that night, very shortly into working with her, I went to sleep. It was pretty early, a lot earlier than it is right now. It must have been about 10 o'clock New York time. And
we're a late show there, Alfonso.
Well, you know, I'm become a night owl too, so
perfect.
I love it personally. But, you know, when I went to sleep, I woke about 3 hours later, and I wasn't lucid dreaming. You know, nothing, no substances or intoxication. And I woke up, and I started seeing not the unicorn, but its horn start materializing right in front of the air mattress that I was sleeping on upstairs in Vikasha's home, and it was spiraled, it was multicolored, and it was there for about 5 minutes before it, you know, returned, you know, to wherever it was going. And I took that as a sign that, yes, we're on the right track, telling people and reigniting the public's, you know, awareness of the unicorn and what it's done throughout history. And, you know, what I believe it may, you know, do going into the future here.
I was fascinated as a kid, Alfonso, with the unicorn. I just thought that animal was just so magical. And I, when I was little, I believed it was real.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I wish I could say the same, but in my childhood, like growing up in the 80s, my only real understanding of the unicorn was on like Lisa Frank folders and usually from the girls in my classes. But when I had that experience, it again, once you see something in your own eyes and you see it before you, you know, the historical evidence that we found in these different cultures and the different figures who encountered the unicorn, that's great evidence. And that kind of got me close the way in terms of believing in it. But once you see it with your own eyes, it just really reinforces it. And, you know, I knew I was on the right track here, you know, writing this book.
And back to Reiki for a moment. Are you like a hands-on healer? How does that work for you?
Yeah, so the way it works is basically there's a few symbols that you have to you know, kind of write on the palms of your hands before you start the practice on yourself or on anyone else. And once you do that, then you basically place your hands in 8 different points of the body that, you know, basically kind of line up with chakras or meridians. And after you do that, it really does a lot towards balance, towards healing if someone has a physical or a psychological issue, or even if you're good, just staying in that right track. And, you know, just one of the most amazing things that I saw with Reiki is when I was working with Jeff, the entrepreneur that I was apprenticing under. You know, the first 3 months were like any working relationship with any other entrepreneur. We were just really cracking down and programming on this app. But as his cancer really progressed, you know, it sort of became a split role for the next 3 months of working on the app. And when the pain started really coming to him, you know, it was more like being a caretaker to him. And the last 3 months that we worked together before he passed, it was really just taking the caretaker role. And you know, he was a finance guy, you know, graduated from University of Pennsylvania, hedge fund. It's not really a culture, a kind of kind of landscape that you really think about people really being open to these kinds of things. But, you know, I saw he was really struggling, and I told him, you know, hey, Jeff, you know, I practice Reiki, and he didn't know what it was, so I told him about it. And I started practicing Reiki every time we worked at his home, and I think it gave him a lot of peace. And even though, you know, he still passed away from the cancer, I think it really gave him a lot of piece in the last few months of his life, and really took away a lot of the worst of the pain as he, you know, as he was dealing with this challenging circumstance.
Is Reiki part of a meditation process? How do you get into it?
You know, meditation is closely aligned, but it's not quite exactly, you know, the same as Reiki. Meditation is a great thing to help still your mind, and they usually kind of, you know, work in tandem with Reiki, but you don't have to. So it's kind of a little bit separate, but at the same time, pretty close, you know, close parallels there.
That's pretty amazing. The book is called The Book of the Magical Mythical Unicorn. Where do you get the book, Alfonso?
You can get it on Amazon, you know, in the U.S. or Canada or wherever you are globally. You can also get it on Walmart.com. You can get it on those spaces would probably be the best place.
Now, I don't have a website for you, so people can find you where? On Facebook?
We have a Facebook page called facebook.com/magicalmythicalunicorn. And you can also go to the website, theunicornbook.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at my personal handle, which is Book Cart Pusher, where I talk a little bit about the Book of the Magical Mythical Unicorn, Reiki, and basically different projects that I'm working on now or will work on in the future.
You were saying that if the unicorn is a real creature, that it could be dimensional, coming from another area. How does it get here?
I'm not sure about the science of how it gets here, but what I can tell you, George, is the why of it. There's a book that was really a breakthrough for us to help with the process. We worked very closely with this author, Michael Green, who had a translation of an ancient Gnostic text that traces back to 14th century Italy called the Codex Unicornis. And in that, it really details how the unicorn was associated with the Edenic paradise. And the reason why the unicorn is such a special creature, and it's a little different from things like Loch Ness or Bigfoot, is that the creator, that God basically gave the unicorn that special power through its horns to help us. And when, you know, we had the fall and you know, that paradise was gone, and we had to, you know, enjoy the wonderful things in life, but also the challenges in life, the unicorn was given a choice where it could either stay in that pure, higher dimensional bliss, or it could pop in and out of dimensions as needed. And because it has such a love for humanity, a care, like almost like a caretaker role for us, it basically worked with the creator and said to the creator, yes, I want to be able to help humanity during chaotic times, when things are, you know, in a bit of upheaval, like they are today.
Even the mythical of a unicorn was written about by Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes, and so many other historical figures. I was just amazed throughout the course of writing this book with Vikasha, just how many figures knew about the unicorn, had these personal experiences. I mean, even some figures who, you know, when you think about the peace and joy and healing of the unicorn, you don't think of a person like Genghis Khan, a fierce terror of Asia and the Middle East and Eastern Europe. But Genghis Khan, you know, was a figure who the unicorn appeared before. And that's the reason he didn't destroy India, because he saw the unicorn at the foot of Mount Jatanaring, you know, in the Himalayas. And that really, the unicorn saved India. I think a lot of other cultures wish the unicorn was there too, because Genghis Khan and his men, wrecked those areas. But yeah, there's a lot of amazing figures, from Da Vinci to Genghis Khan to Alexander the Great, Confucius. So many notable figures throughout history have known the unicorn or even seen it.
Why in the medieval pictures do they show the unicorn's horn to be about 2 or 3 feet long in its head?
You know, because depending on the culture and when the unicorn appears, there's been all different sizes of the horn. Sometimes it is that long, sometimes it's even longer, and sometimes it's a lot shorter. So there's a lot of variations in terms of how the unicorn may look. There's even different color variations. I think most people are probably more familiar with the traditional depiction of a white unicorn. But if you look at a lot of the Middle Eastern traditions where the unicorn's called the Karkadan, a lot of the time the unicorn is black over there with also a black horn. And there's differences not only in the size of the horn and the color of it, but also the spiral. Sometimes it's spiraled, sometimes it's straight. So, you know, just like the diversity of people, you know, there's still that same kind of diversity with the unicorn, you know, the different types of unicorns. There is a lot of variance there.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment, Alfonso, and take some phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The name of the book? The Book of the Magical Mythical Unicorn. So check in with us on that, or also a question or two about Reiki.